Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Dr. Thorsten Pollitt and Ira Harris. Thorsten is Chief Economist of DeGusa and Honorary Professor of the University of Beirut. He also acts as an investment advisor. And Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003 and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hello, Richard. It's great to be on your show.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a discussion on your thoughts for the global economy and the financial markets in general. Thorsten?
Well, yeah, thank you for, first of all, for having the opportunity to talk to you and to Ira about the interesting issues as far as the global economic system is concerned. Well, I would love to start with inflation. I think inflation has become a huge problem, not only in Europe, but across the world. In Europe, the annual consumer goods price inflation runs at 7.5% in March 2022. That's the highest rate ever since the introduction of the euro in January 1999. And I'm very concerned that the inflation problem has come to stay. It's, from my point of view, not a transitory development, but central banks in particular have increased the money supply in recent years at an enormous rate. And I think the consequence is now that the negative price shocks we see related to the lockdown crisis and also now to the war in Ukraine make this monetary overhang translate into higher prices. And that is what we're seeing now. And I think central banks are not doing enough to curb inflation. And so I'm pretty much concerned about inflation and the consequences it has.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see as the drivers of that? Is it like supply chain disruptions from the COVID crisis or maybe from the Russian-Ukraine war and the sanctions thereof?
Well, maybe first of all, I should make some remarks about what inflation is. I mean, the word inflation is used all over the place, and mostly it denotes, or people understand inflation as an ongoing rise in consumer goods prices over time. From an economic point of view, I would argue that inflation is the actual increase in the quantity of money in an economy, and its consequence is higher goods prices. So the increase in the quantity of money is actually the source of inflation, and rising prices are the symptom of the cause, namely an increase in the quantity of money. And as I said, we have, of course, negative price shocks related, let's say, to the energy markets, to food markets, and that is caused by the lockdown crisis consequences. And as I said, the war in Ukraine adds further problems. But in the end of the day, the phenomenon that basically all goods prices increase over time is a monetary phenomenon. Milton Friedman had a famous dictum. He said, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And that is why I see in particular central banks have to put they have to raise interest rates and stop buying securities in order to stop this enormous increase in the money supply.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so you take an Austrian school of economics approach, essentially. And Ira as well. Ira, your thoughts?
No, it's all those, as the Friedman dictum talks about, now everybody can find fault with it and pick at it and find different ways. But and the problem with the Fed was that when they set out upon this course, of course, set by Ben Bernanke, following the great financial crisis, whatever we want to term it, the subprime debt crisis, because I think, you know, out of the Austrian school, following, you know, from Schumpeter and Fischer and everybody else we want to go through. And of course, you know, the backside, it always begins with debt, because the system gets overextended. When loose money, you take on so much debt. Or if you have inflation and real yields are negative enough, people take on debt. You know, people are not stupid. If you want to throw free money at them, they know what that means. So when Ben Bernanke famously went down that course with the portfolio balance channel, I think it was Jackson Hole 2010, and talked, and he was really imbibing upon Keynes's animals. You can call it whatever you want, but he was trying to create and revive the animal spirits in any way, shape, or form. And going back to Schumpeter, we would discuss that, and if the money was being lent to entrepreneurs for developing businesses, that would be one thing. But this just went into asset classes because there was so much money thrown at it. And of course, yeah, we can argue the importance of QE1, but everything after that certainly seemed to be just throwing more coals on the fire when you hadn't even taken the time to see how this was going to play out. And here we are. And now everybody's talking about that Powell needs to find his inner Volcker. You know, we know we're going to talk more about Lagarde, I hope, because I don't know what she's going to find. Is she going to find her inner Otto Pohl? I don't know that that's possible, but this is where it brings us to. And as Schumpeter so beautifully told us, look at central banks and economic systems. If you raise rates high enough, you can slow any economy down, which is really the lessons of Volcker. If you're willing to take the punishment, you can bring it to a halt. But at the same time, Schumpeter said you can take rates as low as you possibly can. But if entrepreneurs are not willing to borrow because they can't make a return on money, and that's really the ultimate measure, capitalism is a return on money for investment, you can't get them to borrow. So you're always stuck, you know, with that concept of pushing on a string. So I think that, as Thorsten says, let's take off from there, because that really brings us to the inflation discussion.
And so if we focus on Europe, Thorsten, what are your thoughts there for Europe? Do you see an emerging financial crisis, especially coming out of the bond market there, and the challenges that are currently happening in the, like with energy and the sanctions with Russia?
I listened very attentively to what Ira said. Quite interesting. He started actually with reminding us about the global economic and financial crisis 2008-2009, when the trouble really started, and back then you had actually a credit crisis. So investors were concerned that borrowers wouldn't pay interest and pay down their debt. So you really had a credit crisis. People feared that defaults would occur on a grand scale. And so the stock market tanked, credit spreads increased sharply, liquidity dried up, so borrowers couldn't roll over their debt. So you had a big credit crisis. And the reaction, as far as central banks are concerned, was to throw new money into the system, to bail out banks, to bail out governments, to bail out big business, but just by just pumping in ever greater amounts of money. And financial markets have learned from this. And to me, it seems that there is a safety net. Most investors think, I'm inclined to think, that central banks have put a safety net under financial markets. So if there's a new risk of a default, central banks will step in and increase the money supply, extend ever greater amounts of credit to fend off another credit crisis. So I think we don't run into a credit crisis in the euro area, and we don't run into a next credit crisis in the US. We get a new form of crisis, namely a currency crisis. And a currency crisis is a situation in which people fear that the purchasing power of their money is getting destroyed. So they try to hold less money, exchange their money against stocks, housing, against real estate, gold and silver, you name it. They want to get out of their currency. And that is a currency crisis. And that's a very dangerous situation in a fiat money system, because to restore confidence in the currency, the central bank has to raise interest rates sharply. It has actually to break rising inflation expectations, a very painful economic situation. And I think we are on the way towards a fully blown currency crisis. It may not be happening, unfolding in the next month, on the next quarter, but I think, and I'm pretty sure, something like this will happen. And you don't have to worry about credit defaults in the first place, or tanking stock markets, or tanking real estate markets. You have to worry about the purchasing power of your money. Well, this is my my reading of the data coming out, and what I hear from policymakers, and well.
Go ahead, Ara.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is really, to me, the point of points. But when we get to a currency crisis, and it is a fiat currency, you know, people say, "Oh, you're a gold bug." I'm not a gold bug. But my sarcastic response back is, "You're a fiat currency bug." If you want to just, and yet, to be in the fiat currency world depends upon good policy making from politicians and credible central banking from the central bankers. And I think we've had neither for quite a long period of time here, which has resulted in exactly where we're at. Now you can point your fingers, and that's not, it's not a finger point. It's that this has taken place. So when Thorsten says that, then I look, and the Fed, I don't believe, truly comprehends this. And now, I don't say that egotistically, but the fact that the dollar is the world's reserve currency, and they don't look at what the ramifications of what their policies have meant on a global basis. And the global basis is that people, countries, corporations all over the world are so borrowed up in dollars because the Fed made it so easy. And everybody, you know, we know that 65% of global, or 61% of global business from commodities and are transacted in dollars. So they made it so easy, and people just borrowed up in dollars. Well, while the dollar is sitting, you know, stable and really not doing much, it doesn't have that big of impact. But we've had a 13% pretty quick rally in the dollar since the beginning of the year. So that squeezes dollar borrowers more and more. And that's because the Fed is trying to set domestic policy when its impact is really global, and they have not owned up to it. So, and what they also don't own up to is where we initially took off from, is that with all the currency that was created, and then you have the ECB, I'm not even going to go into the BOJ because I think they're in an anomalous situation, but the ECB, for the, you know, starting with Draghi, of course, has followed the Fed right down the rabbit hole and probably even more aggressive, you know, and we can get into the Bank of England. So there's been so much liquidity created in the global system, but of course, so much of it is in dollars that when you have a rising dollar and yet you have all these leverage positions and loans that are denominated in dollars that are now starting to get fragile. They're fragile to begin with, but the fragility is starting to show. And if this dollar, due to the Fed policy, because they're late to this, I think had they moved far earlier, if they would have stopped QE in its track, I would say 15 months ago, because the crisis had already abated. And they would have forced Lagarde and the ECB to retract. So you'd be in a far different spot. Why the Fed kept going until literally 6 weeks ago, right? They were still adding 20 billion, we talk about these terms like they're nothing, but 20 billion they were still adding in March of 2022 as they were talking about inflation not being transitory. But it has created a multiplier effect of leverage around the world. So when you go to deleverage the system, nobody knows how brutal it could possibly be. We did see it though. For people to say, well, I've never been here. Yes, we did. 2018, we saw it, and we saw it on a much lesser scale, although, you know, they were raising rates and we got to where 250, like it's something, 250 basis points on the Fed funds, and they were shrinking the balance sheet. And then you saw them roll it back because we had the Christmas Eve when Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin was busy calling around to make sure everybody had enough liquidity. So we're going to go down this road again. But I think the positions are far greater and the leverage in the system is far greater, that they're playing with some dangerous things here.
Yeah. All right. I think if I may step in, Richard, I think that is exactly the central issue you're raising, the debt problem in a fiat currency system. And when Paul Volcker raised interest rates in the, when was it, in the early 1980s?
Yes.
Because the US had such a big inflation problem. Total debt in the economy was around about 140% of GDP. Nowadays, you are close to 400% of GDP. And as you rightly point out, Ira, if the system is leveraged to such an extent, it's really brutal if you raise interest rates after real interest rates having been in negative territory for around about 15 years. I mean, I think this is a nightmare scenario, actually. And it explains, I think, why the Fed has reacted in early 2020 as it did. It basically underwrote to the credit market. It basically said, well, banks, hedge funds, pension funds, whatever credit you have, we buy it at a nice price and we give you new central bank money for it. I mean, that was a monetization of debt on a grand scale in order to prevent the credit crisis from unfolding, as we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And now you basically, if all other central banks follow the Fed into the rabbit hole, as you put it, Ira, then you get even greater monetization of debt further down the road. And that brings me back to the beginning of our talk. I think the inflation problem is really much bigger than most people think it is.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And it crosses so many different asset classes, and the numbers are just gigantic. And I know, I believe that there's a lot of credibility in the Monitor School and the velocity of money, as, you know, Lacey Hunt and David Rosenberg and others talk about. quite a bit. And what their fear is about that we're on the verge of a disinflation to deflationary situation. And it always stems from debt, right? We know that it always stems from debt. And it's interesting that, Thorsten, that you talk about March of 2020, because that's where we go back to when it looked like the system, because of the amount of debt and the fact that the system was shutting down and wouldn't be, and it was a fear that they wouldn't be able to pay their debts, because that's when people start a liquidation panic, which Ben Bernanke set this, the table for of never getting into, right? QE1 was about preventing a liquidation of the system, because I think history has shown that if the United States goes into a liquidation cycle, unemployment will go to numbers that the political system cannot tolerate. So I understood QE1, but 2020, when it happened, and I'm glad we're there, is that the dollar, it became a global situation. So that what did the Fed do? I think March 19th, 2020 was to ramp up their swap lines with all kinds of banks. But interestingly, everybody but the Russian Central Bank and the Chinese Central Bank, which was interesting even at the time. So they ramped that up. Now I think that they think they can avoid this with that standing repo facility, that they can pump enough liquidity because it's such a flexible, you know, I always love when Lagarde uses those terms. Well, our policy is we have optionality and flexibility. And I think that's what the Fed sees with the standing repo facility, that anybody who has any kind of collateral can come to the Fed and they can pour basically unlimited amounts because there's so much flexibility in it. And the fact that foreign institutions, meaning banks, can get up to, I think the number is $60 billion in cash if they have collateral to pledge. So they think that they can get around this, but you know, the numbers have grown. I mean, the fact that the Fed's balance sheet is $9 trillion means that the global, and then we get to the ECB. So I think, you know, you bring up that point, and the fact that the dollar, using the dollar index, which I'm not a big fan of, but it's all we have, is actually higher now than it was in March of 2020. And yet the outstanding loans have grown dramatically.
Yeah. From talking to many American investors, I find that quite a few of them are quite critical about the dollar. And to me, it seems that they often forget that the situation is much worse in other currency areas, you know? So it has more than one side. And what just comes to my mind is, Ira and Richard, there's a Chinese proverb. It's like a riding, he who rides a tiger is afraid to dismount, you know? So stopping, you know, this money creation, credit creation, you know, has severe consequences. And if you try to escape, you have to create more credit and more money. And you pointed out this liquidity swap agreements. Indeed, I mean, this, and I think most people haven't heard about it, but it works like the Fed is creating new dollars and hands them over to the European Central Bank or the Russian Central Bank. And in return, these central banks print their own money, ruble or euro, and hand it over to the Fed. So this is money creation on a credit basis without any collateral, so to speak, or collateral out of thin air, created out of thin air. And I mean, these are instruments which basically increase the liquidity in the system further. And we see how, you know, how hesitant central banks are these days to raise interest rates. And if they don't go up with interest rates, like I would say in the US, interest rate must go to 5 or 6%, but I fear they won't go there, that the Fed will raise them towards 2, 2.5%, and that's it. So the same is gonna happen in the euro area. I fear that central banks won't curb inflation. So we have to prepare ourselves and our investors that inflation in the coming years won't be around 2%, but closer to 5 to 10%. You know, sometimes maybe even higher, sometimes a bit lower, but on average, it will be systematically higher than it was in the last 15 years.
Interesting. And so in terms of this opting of policy response as essentially sacrificing the currency, how low do you think the euro will go? And could there be some type of Plaza Accord agreement, especially given even, you know, the currency volatility in Asia, like with the Chinese yuan and the Japanese yen?
Well, as you know, forecasting currency or exchange rates is a tricky business. but I may say I've been bearish on the euro since January 1999. So I had my ups and downs. Some years I got it right. Some years I got it terribly wrong. Since 2013, I became much more hesitant to come up with concrete numbers and put a timeline to it. But I think there is room now for the euro to go below parity against the dollar. I don't know, maybe in the coming months. I think the chances are relatively high now. The euro dollar exchange rate has broken a very strong resistance level, dropped to below 105. And now I think there's room for going to 0.95 parity, something in that region. I'm hesitant to expect a quick recovery.
And your thoughts, Sarah?
No, it's not about forecasting foreign exchange levels. I'll quote our one who's a frequent guest on your podcast, Louis Gavet, who talks about adapting. So we adapt to it. So, you know, I look at the euro yen, where I can look at it right now. We're at 137. We've been up to 140. I don't know how Germany lives to compete with Japan, with that. I think that's why the euro yen is a particularly important cross for, especially for German industry competing in China. And as Lewis talks about, that the weakening of the yen and its trade advantage is an effort to drive Europe out of China. Now, that's a theoretical basis, and I think it may have some merits to it, but we haven't seen enough of that yet. But I think being that the world is so dependent upon the dollar standard, I think it's very careful here. I'm glad I'm on with Thorsten because we can discuss this. So what's the break point for German citizenry? Because ultimately, being a student and being taught quite a bit by Bernard Connolly, I don't know if you know Bernard, and his views on the rotten heart of Europe from 1995. And I've had the pleasure of so many hours of real deep discussion.
Right.
But what's the, because it's the German credit card that guarantees the ECB. I don't care what anybody tells me, who else would buy Italian debt at 1%, let alone 3%, unless you thought that it was the Bundesbank and the German taxpayer standing behind it. Where's the break point?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And you're absolutely right in saying that the whole euro project wouldn't survive if Germany would get out of the single currency area. That's for sure. And it's basically German credit that keeps the system afloat. You know, there's a lot of let's call it propaganda or mind massage. You know, that the European project is the most important achievement as far as macroeconomic policy is concerned. And this narrative is, you know, I think the great majority of the Germans have fallen victim to it. And so the price to pay is of course, already high. It will become even higher. But the point that Germany would get out of the euro area is still, I think, in a relatively remote distance. You know, it's not around the corner. People accept high inflation. And, you know, as I said, inflation is now 7.5%. Now, I mean, this is just the official, that's just the official number. Producer prices are up more than 30% year on year. So there's more inflation to come. But in the general discussion, in the public debate, it's not really, people don't blame the European Central Bank for higher inflation. They blame higher oil prices for inflation and Putin. And that brings us back to economic theory. If you don't have a clue about the cause and consequences of certain policy actions, you may, you know, you don't draw the right conclusions. And I think Germany is trapped in, it's like a mouse trap. You know, you can't get in, but you can't get out. The euro area project is a mousetrap for the Germans. They will sink with it, and they won't seek the exit door before the mess becomes really big.
I don't think, I'm glad, Thorsten, you're talking about that, because the real effects of it now, and you say, I have written about this for a long, long time. And I always compare it. We have a movie here in the United States called The Bronx Tales with Robert De Niro.
Oh, and I love Robert De Niro, yeah.
So in this movie, The Bronx Tale, if you have a chance, it's really good. But there's the mafioso who hangs in a bar and a group of motorcycle guys who come in and want to start trouble. And they tell them, hey, you can come in, you can have a beer, but behave yourself. Well, of course, they can't behave themselves. So the head mafia guy says, lock the doors. And he says to him, we told you you could have a drink and then you could leave. Now you can't leave. And that's the way I always compare.
I love it, Ira. I love it. That's it.
That's the Germans, as you rightly say, they're trapped here, because if they left, the repercussions would not just be for Europe and for Germany. The world, to me, would go into a major depression, because the debt hit, because so much debt is now predicated on the guarantee of the Germans, that if they pulled the guarantee, you would have massive losses. You know, people are talking about the bond market losses that we're experiencing over the last 6 months. It would be nothing. It would be so dramatic. It would make Lehman look like kindergarten.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about the fiat currency system earlier, and in a fiat currency system, over time, the debt load keeps building up. It becomes bigger and bigger, and the crises that hit become more severe and more dangerous, and you need ever greater amounts of credit and money and lower interest rates to keep the system afloat. And at some point, the costs of getting out are so big, no one is prepared to accept them. And then the only route left is printing money, ruining the currency. And I think, I'm not a pessimistic guy, but when I think about the political ramifications of a fiat currency system, such a scenario looks very likely to me, and it may be accompanied by policy of price controls, to prevent the system from collapsing. The government interventionism becomes more widespread. Rationing of food, upper limits for certain transport prices, etc. You name it. We had it in the 1930s in Germany. They called it command economy. Yeah, well, yes, I think this is something which politicians may adopt in order to reduce the inflationary consequences a bit and prevent the system from falling apart. And well, this is, of course, not only a development I could imagine in Germany, but across Europe as a whole, and even in the United States of America.
Yeah, it's Richard, you want to because we saw this. So when Lagarde first took over the ECB, and she made that major faux pas when she said, it's not our mandate to keep credit spreads in line, right? And so they blew out
absolutely
the German, Italian, they blew out all the credit spreads, and she had to walk that back. So it told, and now she's terrified of that. And,
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That was exactly the situation in which she tried to take away the safety net under the financial system. And financial market didn't take it kindly, you know. It's and so she had to put it back to reassure financial markets. Okay, we are ready, you know, to do whatever it takes and to inject liquidity. And so now, I mean, if I don't have a crystal ball, Ira, what will happen? But if these are the conditions which people accept, that you can, that you are in favor of a policy that prevents a credit default, by all means, then you end up in an inflationary regime. I think it's as simple as that.
Well, the secret to debt relief has for centuries upon centuries been, of course, to inflate away your debt. And you know, people really forget, if you go to Rogoff and Reinhardt, and I have great respect for Carmen Reinhardt because of her work on financial repression, which is unbelievable after World War II and the way the Fed operated. But Rogoff's answer to dealing with the debt overhang from the great financial crisis was to run inflation of 4 to 6% for a few years to offer relief to the debtors. I mean, it's as old as time itself. Whether you're clipping gold coins or silver coins or
it's like people talk about the inflation tax, you know. It's reduce the real debt load by causing inflation, the borrower benefits at the expense of the creditor. But let me add this, in history there's a third way of reducing debt, that was killing the lender. That happened too, right?
Yeah, right.
And inflation is of course the instrument, and people to some extent already accept it. I just mentioned that in the last 15 years in the United States of America, as well as in the euro area, real interest rates have been negative on average by, I don't know, between 1% and 1.5% on average, roundabout. And people, that's my guess, will accept a negative real interest rate of minus 3%. But it's of course disastrous for the great majority of the people. It destroys the savings, it causes malinvestment, and these issues are basically related to having put into place a fiat currency system. Very unfortunate. Very unfortunate. It has worked for decades, but now I think it runs into a very difficult situation.
Well, I know, Richard, go ahead, but I know what we see it when Nixon in August of 71 took, of course, America off. Not the gold standard, because we weren't, but not the gold exchange standard, as people like Jacques Roof and others really explained. And the United States understood, but it required, and Paul Volcker, who was actually instrumental in advising Nixon at that time, really, he does a true mea culpa when he gets his hands on the Fed and undoes that. And he took, people really don't understand, but if you look at the yield curve, the yield curve went to an inversion of 600 basis points. Do you think this Fed has has any capacity for that. It gets to flat or a little bit negative, and they start to get very nervous about what's going on. So it took a negative 600 basis points to wring inflation out of the system. All right, Richard, I'm sorry, I preempted you.
But let me just add, Ira, it's very interesting what you just said. And I think from what I read, inflation was really bad in the United States at that time. And people realized that it has tremendous political, economic, and social costs. And so people were prepared to accept that interest rates would go up, that the economy would slow down, that you would even have a recession, to clean the slate. And when I look at the current situation, as we discussed earlier, I think people are not yet prepared, to do something against inflation, because they think inflation will be transitory or inflation won't be so bad. And I think people have to will learn over time that inflation has to be curbed at some point, but that situation hasn't arisen.
And given just the last question, given this environment and the many challenges, how does an investor protect in this, or what trading opportunities make sense? What investment opportunities make sense from an asset class perspective? I mean, you've got the types of tips or those type of investments may be based or indexed to inflation, but index may not be appropriately be calculated, right? It's accurately calculated, but not appropriately calculated. So, maybe that doesn't make sense, but what does make sense in your view? Thorsten?
Well, inflation is a tricky thing. And the problem is inflation shows up in many areas. It can show up in consumer goods prices and producer prices. It can show up in housing prices or in stock prices. And we don't know for sure where it will show up next time. but as a starting point, I think it's important to understand that inflation is a problem and remains a problem, and that you have to do something against it. I mean, as far as Germany is concerned, the Germans have time savings and demand deposits with banks in the amount of 4 billion euro at the moment. No interest rate, inflation at 7.5%. Inflation may go double digit. And one possibility is to take time and savings deposit and exchange them against physical gold and silver, as a kind of liquid element in your portfolio. And if you are not an expert in analyzing companies, I would recommend a broadly defined stock market index. Just stay long the stock market and hold it for the long term. Hold it for 3 or 5 years or even longer. I think this is a chance to weather the storm reasonably well. And that's basically it. That's my recommendation.
Great, interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, because I'm more of a trader, Thorsten looks at it, so I'll go in and out and out. But when I think in the long-term perspective, of course, I come and I'm watching very closely China and Russia, because when people talk about digital central bank currency, to me, if Russia or China were to go that route and preempt the Fed anyway, the ECB is nowhere near. They've got so many problems to work out that I'm not even paying attention to their statements about it. But if China, I think that if they were to establish that, I'm not a big fan of electronic money, because I think it's a way to repress people even greater. Because as the Europeans saw, when you go to negative yields, negative nominal yields, people have alternatives. But if you had digital and electronic money, no, they can go to negative 5% and force you to spend your money. unlike now where you can do other things with it. So I'm not in favor of electronic money, not at this point in time, maybe somewhere further down the road, but it'll be interesting for me. And I know I've talked about it and people go, oh, he's talking about it again. If the Chinese and the Russians were to actually go to a central bank digital currency that is somewhat backed by precious metals, a little bit of gold, some, especially with the Chinese, because the Chinese, when they were really put upon by Western colonialists, they were on the silver standard. And of course, the most powerful empire at the time, the Brits, sought to break the back of China by undermining silver. So I would look for those. I still believe those. I think Thorsten's view on the stock market are correct, but you have to be wise in what you go to. I'm actually, the European banks have been so badly depressed for so long that if things started to normalize at all, I would look to the European banks. I know that they're they're suffering under the Russian sanctions, so they're under a heavy weight. But outside of that, bonds scare me. And I know people who think that there's a coming deflation because of the slowdown in velocity of money. But I look at the bond market, and I look at the beatings that people have taken over the last 6 months. European, look at the about 4 months. The fact that people were buying bonds at negative 50 basis points, a 10-year government sovereign piece of debt that is now basically, let's say, 90. So they've taken enormous losses, capital losses, if they had to sell them. And of course, we know that if we got into a situation where there had to be a liquidation, you'd have to sell them. So the losses are not just, they will be realized. So those kind of scare me. I still believe that we're in a inflationary, a commodity cycle that's positive, because it's just where we're at. China is still a growth story. India is going to be a growth story if it can get out of its own way. So we see all types of things. And what happens with the Russian sanctions, I don't know. I'm not smart enough to see where they're going to go here. But I know enough about studying war and history that you better offer them some type of out. If you try to crush them, it will not end up in any positive, because they'll continue this until there's nothing left of something. And the Germans are really in a difficult situation, of course, because Gerhard Schroeder has put them in that situation, and Merkel certainly aided and abetted it. So where that's going to go, they're not getting off of Russian natural gas anytime soon without absolutely collapsing the German economy. So there are a lot of uncertainties, but this has been a great discussion. And I think we can pick it up more, because the issue is the ECB for the global as to what we do. And we haven't gotten to one of my favorite subjects, and maybe Thorsten could talk about the Swiss National Bank and how he sees what they've done before we leave.
Yeah, very interesting. How are your thoughts? The Swiss have linked their Swiss franc exchange rate to the euro. When was it? I think in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, and in January 2015, they ended this exchange rate pegging, and now they manage the Swiss franc external value. They allow an appreciation over time, a gradual appreciation over time, buying huge amounts of dollars, taking the money and exchanging that against stocks. So they own Google and Alphabet, and I think they were great investments. But in the fiat currency universe, the Swiss franc is, I think, an exception. If you wish to put your money into a fiat currency, I would recommend the Swiss franc in the long term. At the moment, you have negative interest rates. If you're an institutional investor, you have to pay a negative yield on your deposits. But the Swiss have succeeded in not destroying the purchasing power of the Swiss franc. Since the early 1970s, the Swiss franc is an appreciating currency against the rest of the world. And they've and it helped them to become wealthy. But I, just if you have some Keynesian listeners, Richard, I just want to mention that. Switzerland ranks amongst the wealthiest countries in the world as far as per capita GDP is concerned, and they have an appreciating currency since decades. And I think they will take care of their currency. So I'm quite confident as far as the Swiss franc is concerned, and the Swiss franc will appreciate further against the euro at some point considerably, because there will be a point in time where they have to abandon any currency pegging vis-a-vis the euro.
Yeah.
As I say, they're the greatest alchemists in the world. They've taken take their printing press and they turn it into gold. Apple, right. So they've done it. When you really look at it, it's not like buying, you know, they buy bonds, of course, because I just saw they came out with their quarter.
Yeah, they're the biggest lender for Germany.
And they suffered, you know, I have it here. I'm sorry. They lost $34 billion in the first quarter because of their bond purchases, not because of equity purchases.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, I just show you something. And Richard, I don't know if you can see that one. German currencies from the late 1990s, from the late 1970s to the euro. We had so many currencies in Germany, you know, they're all gone. After 25 years, they were ruined. Now we have the euro, and we haven't seen any improvement as far as this is concerned. And the Swiss have the Swiss currency for hundreds of years.
You know, I still keep the DMARC quote on my board. So we're at 185.60.
Yeah, it's frozen forever.
To the dollar, DMARC. I guess, you know. Yeah. So I can tell you it would be the synthetic rate right now, 185.60. All right.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you. I look forward to another one.
Yeah.
Another one. Yeah.
Thanks, Richard.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have a nice day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yes.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.